From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Emergency crews in central Italy continue to search and rescue operations after yesterday's pre-dawn earthquake, which has killed at least 250 people. Many of the homes in three of the hardest hit towns, even if they remain standing, have been deemed uninhabitable. And today, a strong aftershock in one of those towns, Amatrice, caused even more damage and no doubt more anxiety too. The town of Pescara del Tronto was also hit hard, and that's where reporter Chris Livesay is. First of all, Chris, can you describe exactly where you are and what you're seeing?
Sure. I'm standing over a ravine right now that runs right through the middle of this town of Pescara del Tronto. You might even be able to hear the river running behind me. The contrast couldn't be more stark. What's normally a beautiful central Italian town with, you know, medieval buildings and charming winding roads has been reduced to rubble. It's as if a war zone broke out right here in the middle of a little piece of paradise. It's pretty stark.
And you've been speaking with people in that town. What have they been telling you?
Well, they're just shocked. I mean, the earthquake struck just after 3:30 in the morning, local time, yesterday, while people were sleeping. And those who survived woke up to find half of their town had basically vanished overnight. Now, this town is typically a population of only 60 people, but because it's high season for tourism, its population tends to quadruple around this time of year. So that increased the amount of death and casualties, unfortunately. Speaking to local rescue workers, they say approximately 30 people were killed in this site alone.
Well, we have a little bit of tape of one woman that you did speak to. She was very emotional about losing her home, but she said that she and her family, at least, were alive and that was extraordinary. Here's that tape.
Sono parte di tutta la gente che è morta, che noi conoscevamo tutti, perché noi non siamo di questo paese, però sono 29 anni che abbiamo questa casa qui.
E quindi è come... Can you tell us a little bit more about what she told you?
Sure. She told me that she has a pretty big extended family. They've been here for about 29 years. But she said this marks a new chapter for their life. They're not planning on ever coming back here. She said that this town is practically a ghost town by now.
Well, can you tell us about how rescue operations are going, especially in these smaller towns that have been hit?
Well, so a little glimmer of hope actually happened in this town. Recently, they were able to extract a little girl named Georgia from her house after she'd been buried under the rubble for many, many hours. The sad part of the story was that her sister was not so lucky, and she, in fact, died. So stories like these of at least somebody who does survive the tragedy, that's giving people more reason to hope. Right now, as we speak, they're trying to save two people they know to be trapped inside of a home that I'm looking at right now. However, no one appears to be very optimistic about them being alive at this point. They think too much time has gone by. And they also comment on the construction of this building. I spoke to a geologist earlier today who said that the fact that these buildings are so old and made out of, you know, medieval stone building techniques, they tend to crumble when there's a devastating earthquake like this. And when the structures crumble, there's usually no hope. And that appears to be the case with these two people that they're trying to extract as we speak.
Now, Chris, did you say that you can actually see the rescuers working on this house right now?
That's right.
Can you describe to us a little bit about specifically what are you seeing?
Well, I'm seeing they basically blocked off access to this house, first because of safety and second because of preserving the dignity of the victims. Rescuers have been very careful to cover up bodies with sheets and preventing anyone from getting a look when they pull out the body. So they're doing a good job of making sure they keep us far away. They don't seem to be working very urgently right now, which also suggests that they've already determined that these people aren't alive. However, I can't say that for sure. It could have a lot of different factors, considering, for instance, that the building might simply be too unsafe for them to move in quickly.
Well, that's reporter Chris Livesay speaking to us from the town of Pescara del Tronto. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the Colombian government and the rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, have reached a peace agreement that will bring an end to more than 50 years of fighting if it's approved by voters. The deal comes after 4 years of negotiations, and it still needs to be approved in October in a referendum. Journalist Ali Velshi has been following this and joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy, this is a pretty big development. We knew in June that a deal was coming because they had reached a preliminary deal. But the idea that they've actually hammered out the stuff that they can vote on in October is incredible.
And I want to hear about the terms of the deal. But why don't we just remind people who haven't been following this or haven't heard about FARC in years,
yep,
what they are?
Well, most countries in the world think FARC is a terrorist organization. It was founded in 1964. It was the armed wing of the communist movement. It was a Marxist-Leninist movement in Colombia. The main founders were small farmers and landowners. They banded together to fight inequality. There may be 7,000 members of it. They may have been 20,000 members at some point, including a lot of civilian support. But they have been fighting the Colombian security forces for decades now, and largely been fueled by money that has come out of the drug trade, by coca farming. So it has really moved from being a purely communist organization, Marxist-Leninist agrarian organization, into being a drug-fueled rebel group.
So what are the terms of this peace agreement?
Well, they're going to demobilize their fighters. They're counting them as 7,000 fighters. They're going to be able to demobilize at designated camps or protected zones. The UN will help monitor it. They'll have 180 days to fully disarm, and former fighters can enter civilian life. It'll be a bit like the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Hmm. If you admit to anything you've done, you'll be given a bit of a pass. And if you don't and you're convicted, you could go to jail for a long time. They won't be allowed to run for political office, but FARC members will have representation in Congress insofar as figuring out parts of this peace deal.
And there are concerns that members of FARC who have done bad things are not going to be punished enough for those things.
Yeah, and look, polling indicates that fully one-third of Colombians are absolutely against a peace deal with FARC. They think that they are absolute terrorists. About one-third of the population supports this deal, and about one-third are undecided. The former president of Colombia is against this, and he's leading a campaign to have a no vote in October because there are a lot of Colombians who say these people have wreaked havoc on our society and our economy. We do not want to make a peace deal with them. They should be crushed.
As you mentioned, Ali, the U.S. State Department says FARC is a terrorist organization, and the U.S. has also given billions of dollars in aid to Colombia to combat drug trafficking. What is this peace deal, if it is approved, mean for the war on drugs, the U.S. war on drugs, and for drug trafficking?
Well, what we've realized is in the last few months, as this deal was expected, drug growers have planted more and more coca ahead of the peace deal, sort of in a hope that they're trying to make as much money as possible before they have to get out of the drug business. What that'll likely mean is a bumper crop of cocaine that'll probably make its way into the United States and all the negativity that goes along with that. But there is some sense that if everybody starts to join hands and we get a little more coca production out of the way, it could reduce it. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody in Colombia or South America is not going to grow coca or make cocaine, but it may have long-term benefits, short-term a boost in cocaine production.
And what about for the nation of Colombia? This is a war with the FARC that has killed some 220,000 people and displaced millions. Are we expecting that there would be stability coming back to Colombia?
Yeah, even people who don't like the deal and don't like FARC do realize that nearly 7 million people have been displaced. The UN says it's the highest number of internally displaced people in the world. Syria is giving it a run for its money. There are landmines that have killed 11,000 people. There have been kidnappings and bombings and ransom. A lot of people in Colombia say there isn't a single family who hasn't been affected by the war. So, they're weary of it. They're tired of it. Whoever's right or wrong, Colombians need to see an end to this fighting. And now that there's actually a deal, the numbers of people in support of it might actually increase.
And as things may get more stable in Colombia, we're watching what's happening right next door in Venezuela. And you and I have talked about this.
Yeah.
There's an economic crisis there, a shortage of food and medicine. And earlier this month, Venezuela and Colombia agreed to gradually reopen their border. How might what's happening in Colombia affect Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela, first of all, is one of the few countries that doesn't consider FARC a terrorist organization. Mm. But separate from that, Venezuela's broke. It has more oil and more oil reserves than anyone else in the world, but it has Bolivar, the currency, has collapsed. It can't buy goods. Store shelves are empty. There's been rioting all over Venezuela. And the net effect of this is Venezuela's oil output has actually declined because it doesn't have the money to even maintain its oil facilities. In the end, Venezuela might suffer dramatically, and it might result in the price of oil going up because such a big producer is actually going to have to slow down its production just because it doesn't have the right machinery and it's not up to good repair.
That's Ali Velshi, a journalist, talking with us about what's happening in Venezuela and Colombia, a peace agreement with the FARC. Ali, thanks.
Pleasure.
We've reached the time of year when students are headed off to college and parents are either jumping for joy or crying that they have an empty bedroom in the house. Let's bring in Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, my high school. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
And, you know, it's not new for students and their parents to adjust to this big change of a student going off to college, but is there stuff that is new about that transition in 2016 versus 20 years ago or 40 years ago?
Oh, yeah. I think about my college experience. It was basically getting dropped off at the curb and sometimes wishing your parents goodbye and a safe trip and them hugging you, and you were kind of on your own. And now, Jeremy, colleges know that parents have concerns and fears, so they are doing parent orientations. They're creating parent support service offices. The social media aspect of this kind of culture of posting that you're always happy is now a part of their transition.
Well, I saw that you had written to students to say, make sure that you also post about the bad things that happen when you do badly on a test or something like that.
Yes, be authentic. We keep telling them to even get into college, write that authentic voice, and then they get into college and it's like, everyone has to be happy. Everyone has to be transitioning well. And sometimes they come back and visit you. And it's before Thanksgiving break, and you say, how are things going? And you can tell they're having struggles because transition is hard.
So what should students be doing to transition? And we'll talk about parents in a moment. But first, for students who are heading off to college, what would you tell them?
Go in knowing that college is not easy. There are highs and lows. This isn't a Hollywood experience here. And let go of that FOMO, that fear of missing out. You know, college has so much there for them to take advantage of, and they don't want to overwhelm themselves because they're experiencing so many other things. New roommates, new food, new campus. They have to be proactive. Talk to their parents about what is the support or the communication and keeping in touch they would like to see happen with their parents. And I also think they have to know that there are so many resources on campus. Jeremy, I can't tell you. I'm blessed to work in a small school where the alums graduate and keep in touch with me, but so many times they call me and I can tell they're hurting, and I will say, by any chance, did you think of going to the writing center or think of going to the counseling center? And they often say, no, I didn't know I could. So they do have to know what's available and take advantage of it. They're paying a student fee. Use it.
What about communicating with your old friends at high school? And I know sometimes people can take that too far. You know, they don't want to adjust to their new life in college and meet new people. So they just, especially now with their phones, can just constantly stay in touch with all their old friends.
Yeah, I do believe, and I tell them, keep those friends, keep in touch, but you have to step out of that comfort zone and reach out and make new friends. Some may actually go and say, I'm reinventing myself. I'm going to keep in touch with my high school friends less. And some may just need a little bit of reassurance during that homesickness phase, and a quick text to one of their best friends and getting a nice reply back might actually help them get through that day.
What about for parents adjusting to that empty bedroom in the house and wanting to stay probably too much in touch with their kids?
Right. Well, I often say to parents, first of all, the trust you have with your child while they are away in college is crucial. What that means is, while you may want to turn that spare bedroom into a home gym, don't do that the first year. They really need to be able to come home and know that they have something that they know is a security of what they remember and love. But let the child, again, take the lead about how much they want to video chat. Do they want to get text messages from you daily? I do think parents also have to be realistic. They need to expect mistakes from their child. So I would say one of my final tips to parents, Jeremy, would be, they need to learn to coach their student through this transition and not rescue them. even if you get that phone call and they're crying. Take a breath, listen more than you speak. And once again, parents have a responsibility of also knowing what those resources are on campus, so that before they try to solve that problem, they need to say, did you go and talk to anyone? Have you gone to office hours because you're struggling in class? Parents need to model that for their student.
I know we've been talking about all the difficult things about adjusting to college, but you've now made me really just want to go back to college and be starting all again. That would be so much fun. Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School, my old school in Urbana. And we'll put her tips for students who are headed off to college and their parents at our website, hereandnow.org. Lisa, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy. I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, what about transitions at the elementary school level? How's this for a change? A Texas second grade teacher announced that she will not assign any homework to her students this year. The letter that Brandy Young of Godley Elementary School sent to parents went viral. And why? Well, Young says homework doesn't actually help her students and that she'd rather have them spend time with family, reading, and eating dinner together. Well, we wanted to see if research on kids and homework supports Young's decision. Dr. Jeffrey Brosco is the Director of Clinical Services at the University of Miami's Mailman Center for Child Development. He joins us via Skype. Dr. Brosco, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
Well, first of all, in that letter that got so much attention on social media, the teacher, Mrs. Brandy Young, says, quote, "Research has been unable to prove that homework improves student performance." Let me ask you, does the research bear that out?
That's true, although it depends on the age of the child. There's been 30 or 40 years of research looking at this. And if you look at elementary school kids up till fifth grade or so, there really is no evidence that homework improves academic outcomes. If you measure kids who get homework or don't get homework and compare them, their reading, writing, math skills are pretty much the same at the end of the year. So from that point of view, she's absolutely right. There's probably some reason to start doing homework in middle school and high school, and probably 1 to 2 hours seems to be the right amount for especially high schoolers. And that does seem to improve academic outcomes.
So academic outcomes, though, what about the other potential benefits that homework could bring? Routine, focus, discipline,
right,
getting used to doing this kind of work outside of school?
Exactly. So these are all ideas that homework might be useful for. Again, there's not research showing that it does. I've heard parents say that this is a good way for the school to sort of communicate what a child's learning because they see what the worksheets show. The problem, of course, is to the degree that parents take on the homework as their own, then that chance of independence and organization and responsibility can get lost.
That, of course, is an entirely different discussion, but one which we have had here on the show. But let me ask you, so in that case, if we're looking at academic performance and you're saying that we have, 30 or 40 years of research which show that it may not improve academic performance, especially in the younger grades, what is a creative teacher to do? Is just, you know, ending homework outright the right way? Or could teachers find other forms of, I'm putting this in quotes, homework that does provide some benefit?
Oh, that's a great question. And I should point out that there are entire school systems, like in the country of Finland and Sweden, where there is absolutely no homework and their kids' academic outcomes are really superior. And so we should probably be rethinking school a little bit, especially in the elementary school years. You know, we want to encourage curiosity. We want to encourage a love of learning, a good relationship with trying to figure out what's happening in the world rather than making it all about worksheets. You know, if you're learning about math, the assignment might be something like talk to your parents at home and figure out ways they use math. And so maybe you play a board game or cook something with one of your parents, or maybe you build something. So rather than teaching a specific math skill, learning why a particular set of skills might be useful and learning the context in which parents use them might be great. And the same can be true of all sorts of other things. I mean, playing a board game is a wonderful way to develop strategy and develop organization and try and think through things. Plus, you can have fun doing it. So I think homework assignments could be a lot more along those lines and less along the lines of, you know, do these 10 addition problems because we've done it in school already.
You know, this is such a fascinating conversation. And for me, one of the major complications here is that in talking about K through 12 education across the country, there's been a lot of focus on achievement gaps, right, and lower performing districts. And it seems to me that many of those districts are facing a great deal of pressure, and rightly so, to close achievement gaps. And one of the ways they're doing it is to make sure that kids have homework so that there's continuous learning going on, not just, you know, between day to day, but even, you know, over the summer. From what you're saying, is that the right approach to help those kids?
more homework is not the way to do it. And we have to be careful about how we think about parent involvement more generally. It turns out the things that are most important are for parents to have an expectation that their child will do well and go to college, that their parents are generally interested. What did you learn today? What happened in school? And perhaps to some degree that parents help make sure that children get the teacher that best fits their personality and learning style. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the other things that are routinely touted as important, you know, going to the school, meeting with the teachers, joining the PTA, doing a whole lot of other things, probably don't make as much difference. And sometimes we label parents as not being involved when it's not clear that's the best for their child.
Huh. Well, what is it developmentally about the age of elementary school kids that makes conventional homework not as effective?
Well, it's interesting. We published some research looking at rates of ADHD. And I think a lot of people know that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder has more than doubled in the last 30 or 40 years. And we found that as we've increased our academic expectations, we've more than doubled the number of kids who get diagnosed with ADHD and require medications. So there's a downside, too, to sort of increasing our expectations of what children should do at an age that's probably not developmentally appropriate. Learning to sit still for long periods of time doing boring things is not what most five-year-olds want to do. And to the degree that it turns them off from learning and makes school a pure chore is a problem. And the natural curiosity of children really should drive a lot of what we're doing with learning. And so the idea is that math and reading and writing and those sorts of skills are that just that. They're skills to use in the world. They're not an end in and of themselves.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Brosco is director of the University of Miami's Mailman Center for Child Development. He's also a professor of clinical pediatrics. Dr. Brosco, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Families, I'm really interested to know, what are the trends in your district? Are schools doing away with homework or adding on more for elementary schools? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Georgia's Governor Nathan Deal has been trying to transform his state's criminal justice system by pushing for education and occupational training behind bars to prepare prisoners for the workforce when they get out. And that has some felons going from the big house to the firehouse, as Leah Fleming from Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
In the middle of Chester, a rural town about an hour from Macon, Georgia, sits the Dodge County State Prison. Ride through the open gate, and you see the typical-looking prison surrounded by barbed wire. But off to the left, there's a firehouse complete with two bays where shiny red trucks sit poised for action. Outside, a couple of men stand around talking. Their shirts read, Georgia Correctional Fire Services. They are inmates serving time as firefighters. One of them is David Foxworth.
I was originally locked up, arrested for a drug possession charge and a forgery charge.
Foxworth was paroled once, but he was sent back to prison after a probation violation. He spent some time working as an orderly in the warden's office, but then decided to follow in his grandfather's footsteps and become a firefighter.
I slid down the pole, going on field trips with my elementary school, you know, with my grandfather there.
Dodge County Prison is one of 25 state and county prisons with firefighting programs. There are several inmate firefighter programs all across the country, with many drawing some concern. Earlier this month, a man in Northern California was charged with arson after police arrested him for allegedly starting a fire in Clayton that destroyed more than 175 buildings. It turns out the man had worked as an inmate firefighter in 2007 while serving a 5-year prison term for drug and weapons charges. And in April, an inmate serving as a firefighter broke out of a Cal Fire correctional fire camp in Ventura County. He was caught 24 hours later near San Diego. Sean Wombles oversees the fire service at prisons all across the state.
They go through a real tough interview process and then have to pass a physical agility test. and meet our criteria, which is nonviolent offenses, no sexual offenses, no arson convictions, and they must be working toward their GED or already have a high school diploma.
The felons at Dodge now all hold the same certifications that a paid firefighter in Georgia has. And Sean Womble says when you call 911 to report a fire, these are the guys coming to you under an escort.
We have an automatic aid agreement with the city of Chester. They would get in their fire trucks that you see in our bays here, and they would respond down to wherever the call may be.
Not every county in Georgia can afford to pay for firefighting services. So nearly one-third of the state's 159 counties look to prisoners to serve as firefighters. It's funded through the state. As for the firefighters at Dodge State Prison, they have been on several calls, including one that stays in inmate David Foxworth's mind.
Years ago with Chief Kelly, I found a victim inside. And his own children come up crying and hugging my neck, telling me thank you, when their father had just passed away. The appreciation and the gratitude that they have for us, it's a high that no drug could ever give me.
Manager Sean Womble says over 50 inmates have gone on to serve as firefighters after being paroled. As for Foxworth, he expects to be paroled sometime next year. He says he's already lined up an opportunity in a nearby community to be a firefighter once he gets out. That is a start, he says. For Here and Now, I'm Leah Fleming in Macon, Georgia.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised by unusual things on the campaign trail this year, but here's one. Last night in Jackson, Mississippi, Donald Trump rallied supporters with an unusual guest, Nigel Farage, former leader of the UK Independence Party and one of the leaders of the successful campaign for Britain to leave the European Union. On stage, Farage drew a number of parallels between British and American politics.
I come to you from the United Kingdom with a message of hope and a message of optimism. It's a message that says, if the little people, if the real people, if the ordinary decent people are prepared to stand up and fight for what they believe in, we can overcome the big banks. We can overcome the multinationals. And we did it. We made June the 23rd our Independence Day when we smashed the establishment. And we did it. Everybody said we'd lose. And what did we see? We saw experts from all over the world. We saw the International Monetary Fund. We saw Moody's. We saw Standard & Poor's. We saw global leaders giving us Project Fear, telling us that if we voted not to be run by a bunch of unelected old men in Brussels... Yeah, well, it's okay. They don't like me either, so it doesn't really matter, does it? But they told us our economy would fall off a cliff. They told us there'd be mass unemployment. They told us investment would leave our country. And David Cameron, then our Prime Minister, but no longer, told us we might even get World War III. And we saw the commentariat, and we saw the polling industry doing everything they could to demoralize our campaign. On the day of the vote itself, that morning, they put us 10 points behind. And actually, they were all wrong. And they were wrong because what the Brexit campaign did is we reached those people who've been let down by modern global corporatism. We reached those people.
Nigel Farage speaking at a Donald Trump rally last night. Trump took the stage again after Farage spoke and continued his speech.
We will lower taxes and unleash job creation, and we will tap into trillions of dollars in new energy wealth that we never even knew we had before. We will protect your jobs from illegal immigration and broken visa programs. And we will rebuild the roads, the bridges, the infrastructure, the tunnels, the airports in your communities. And we will rebuild it with our companies, with our steel, and with our labor. Clinton is a bigot who sees people of color only as votes, not as human beings worthy of a better future. She's going to do nothing for African Americans. She's going to do nothing for the Hispanics. She's only going to take care of herself, her husband, her consultants, her donors. These are the people she cares about. She doesn't care what her policies have done to your communities. She doesn't care. Remember this. You've had her policies, Democrats, running some of the inner cities for 50, 70, 80, even over 100 years. And look what you have right now. Poverty, no education, crime. You can't walk down the street with your child. We're going to fix it. We're going to fix it.
Donald Trump speaking last night, and joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And the line that really stood out there, and it's been making headlines today from Donald Trump, is Hillary Clinton is a bigot. She responded on Anderson Cooper on CNN last night. Here she is.
Oh, Anderson, it reminds me of that great saying that Maya Angelou had, that when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. And Donald Trump has shown us who he is, and we ought to believe him. He is taking a hate movement mainstream. He's brought it into his campaign.
And today, Hillary Clinton is talking about the alt-right movement in a speech, which she's trying to tie to the Trump campaign. What do you make of all of this, Ron?
First of all, I doubt that Nigel Farage will become the new spokesperson for the Trump campaign, although the Brexit comparison to the Trump campaign is not an idle comparison. Many people were making it back when they had that vote earlier this year in Great Britain, and there was a sense then that it was an anti-establishment vote, an anti-London vote, if you will, an anti-all those who supposedly know better vote. And particularly, it was delightful for the supporters of the Brexit to defeat the pollsters who had dismissed them all along. So, of course, the parallels here are pretty easy to draw for those people who feel alienated from Washington, who feel alienated from globalism, and who feel alienated from the polls that they're seeing showing Donald Trump, their candidate, losing this election. That is hard for them to accept, and they take a lot of comfort in knowing that pollsters can be wrong, as they were in Great Britain. But to turn to the alt-right part of this question, part of the reason that Donald Trump is calling Hillary Clinton a bigot and pushing back very hard on the characterizations of his own campaign is because he has brought on board as his new campaign chairman Steve Bannon, who has called his own digital publication Breitbart.com the digital voice of the alt-right movement. And the alt-right movement is a younger, perhaps hipper, somewhat ironic version of what we used to call racialists, or people who were white supremacists, or people who liked to make a lot of jokes on a racial basis and now are doing it on the internet. That is one of the characterizations of the alt-right.
And we're going to be talking more about that, especially after we hear from Hillary Clinton. But I do want to get your thoughts, Ron, on what's going on her side of the campaign with 15,000, almost 15,000 emails and documents that weren't originally disclosed, the FBI found. This just seems to be drip, 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 drip on this story. What's the latest here, and does it matter?
The 15,000 number probably includes a certain number of duplicates. That's what we've been told, that these are documents that have been seen before, that have been released before, but which the FBI discovered and wasn't sure were the same ones. So we'll see over time as these are all examined. And the latest is essentially that we're going to see this rolled out over the next several weeks before the campaign ends, before the actual election day, and we will see whether or not these documents, these emails, are different from the ones that we've been seeing over the last many months. Actually, this server was first revealed a year and a half ago, so we've been talking about it for quite a long time.
And have we found anything in all of that time that one could say, here's the smoking gun, Hillary Clinton did something wrong, and we know that because of this email?
some of her critics have found in some of her emails indications that she held too long to a mischaracterization of the cause of the death of Ambassador Stevens in Benghazi in Libya in 2012, that she stayed with the party line too long after she should have known better. Some have disputed that as well. But there are things you can find and you can talk about. Nothing along the nature of what someone would call a smoking gun, as we've seen as she has proceeded not only to win the nomination, but also to lead in the polls.
And now people are going to be looking to see whether there's any evidence of these emails that Hillary Clinton at the State Department did favors basically for the Clinton Foundation.
And there is no question that some of the people who gave money to the Clinton Foundation also appealed to her for favors when she was at the State Department. So folks are going to have to look at who those people were and what those favors were. And of course, she has had some characterization, some opportunity to characterize who those people were and what the favors were. And they're also going to have to ask how many of those people had already known Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton for 20, 30, 40 years before there ever was a Clinton Foundation. So the connections will have to be scrutinized, even as the Clinton's own actions will have to be scrutinized.
And we will continue to scrutinize them and talk about them with you, Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, who joins us almost every day these days with the campaign news. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Over the course of this summer, a rash of strange deaths occurred across the country. A teenage girl in Ohio died in June after taking a whitewater rafting trip. Then a Texas lifeguard died in July. And earlier this month, an 11-year-old girl died after swimming in a river. All of these healthy young people had something in common. They fell ill after being in water, and in almost all of the cases, they died incredibly quickly. The killer was a rare, brain-eating amoeba. Paige Flager from The Pulse at Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
The summer of 2013 was a typical one for 12-year-old Kaylee Hartig. She spent most of it swimming at Willow Springs Water Park near her home in Arkansas.
A lot of people would say I used to swim like a fish because I'd love to be in the water.
But after a long day of swimming in July, she felt like something wasn't quite right.
After we had got back home, I had started to have a terrible headache. And Mom thought it was just because I'd been swimming all day and I'd been sunburnt. So she said, well, it's getting late, so you probably just need to go to sleep and we'll see how you feel in the morning.
Overnight, Kaylee's condition only worsened. She had a fever, she felt dizzy, she was vomiting. Her parents took her to Arkansas Children's Hospital for tests.
When they'd done the spinal tap, they actually had a slide there on hand of parasitic meningitis. And it was a dead-on match. So that's when everything started rolling downhill.
That's Kaylee's dad, Joseph Hartig. The infection he's talking about is primary amoebic meningoencephalitis, or PAM for short. It's caused by a microscopic amoeba called Naegleria fowleri, or the brain-eating amoeba. Matt Lynam is a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Arkansas Children's Hospital. He was just starting his shift at the hospital when he got the call about Kaylee.
It's never a diagnosis that you want to see. It's never a diagnosis that you want to give to a family.
He took myself and Tracy into a conference room and laid it out to us. He said she won't make it through the weekend.
A brain-eating amoeba sounds horrifying, but it's actually really rare. There have only been 8 or fewer cases per year since 1962, when the Centers for Disease Control started tracking it. This particular amoeba is usually found in warm, fresh water, like rivers, lakes, or springs. PAM can't be contracted by drinking contaminated water. Infection only takes place when the amoeba goes up somebody's nose. That's why the most common victims are swimmers like Kaylee Hartig. The amoeba got into her nose, climbed up a nerve into her brain, and began to destroy her brain tissue.
The amoeba, in the natural environment, its food source is other bacteria and other amoebas. But when it finds itself not in its natural environment and finds itself in the body, it is drawn to the high oxygen content of the brain tissue, and that it is using it as a food source.
That's Dr. Jennifer Cope, a medical epidemiologist at the CDC. She says that PAM is so deadly because as the amoeba destroys brain tissue, the body responds by sending in immune system forces, and then the brain gets inflamed and swollen, eventually causing death. Because the amoeba is so rare and so fast-acting, no one has been able to nail down a cure.
Because it is so deadly, we kind of throw all the drugs that we know have a possibility of killing the amoeba and put it, you know, give it to the patient.
When Kaylee Hartig got sick in 2013, Arkansas Children's Hospital did just that. They gave her a cocktail of drugs, including an experimental one from Germany supplied by the CDC called miltefazine. Then they brought her body temperature down to minimize the swelling in her brain. And it worked. Of the 142 people who have been documented to have PAM, Kaylee is one of only four U.S. survivors. And still to this day, doctors like Matt Lynam aren't completely sure why.
There wasn't this one magic bullet that that saved the day. I think it was this combination of all these little things that happened just right.
CDC Dr. Jennifer Cope says that one hypothesis is that Kaylee may have been exposed to some other kind of infection before, which caused the amoeba to be less powerful. Regardless of what it was, Kaylee's fight wasn't over.
Basically, Kaylee had to learn to walk, talk, swallow, and write. She had to relearn everything.
Including something that surprised a lot of people. She wanted to learn how to swim again.
Once they let me swim in their pool at Children's, and I knew that I wouldn't get sick, like in a salt-treated or chlorine-treated pool, I was, like, ecstatic because I knew I could still swim, and I loved to swim.
After 55 days, Kaylee Hartig checked out of the hospital and did what most 12-year-olds do when they beat a deadly infection. She held a press conference. A reporter asked her what her advice was for other kids.
Be careful when you go to water parks.
Say, wear your nose plug.
Wear your nose plug.
For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
Going out and buying my nose plug right now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.